Fishtails was started because I really liked listening to The Moth. You might be familiar with NPR's The Moth Radio Hour. And I think it's great that folks can tell true life stories and you can get inspiration from them. And it's also a way that we connect with each other through conversation. We're telling stories all the time. And every once in a while, you get all the elements just lined up perfectly. And we carry these stories around with us our whole lives, and we tell them. And we should tell them because they're make up part of who we are. And that's what Fishtails is all about, really. It's a convening of folks to listen to each other and share stories. So welcome to Fishtails. Again, thank you for being here. So we're going to record. This is our first time recording. And we're going to have it up on the website. So please visit GloucesterWriters.org in the future for some stories. We do have a lineup, but I would encourage anyone else who wants to tell a story toward the end to do so. And at the end, after everyone has provided their stories, I'll do what is called a shout-out. You can sit in your place and you can shout out a story that happened last time, and it was great, and we had a wonderful back and forth. Somebody would say, oh, that happened to me, and then we had this big conversation, so it was kind of fun at the end. Our theme tonight is local, so really anything goes. Right? Our first storyteller is Joel. Joel, come on up. Thank you for
being first. Start timing me.
Oh, by the way, Greg, right up over here is going to be our timekeeper.
Does he give me a clue?
Our signal?
And stories are 5 minutes. I'm sorry I didn't say that. They should be 5 minutes.
So I begin Boston Red Sox. I reveal Berkeley finest teachers. Boston, California. I want you to imagine granite. I want you to think of yourself at the age of 8, or you could be middle-aged, or you could be like I was, 17. I want you to imagine yourself on a horse going down a slope of granite, each step threatening to throw you off into the rock, which was granite. I want you to imagine seeing far below a thin stream of green running water, highlighted by white rapids. I want you to see yourself getting onto the flat, Pine Flat. A narrow strip of sand along the middle fork of the San Joaquin River, about a mile long in its stretch. I want you to hear the silence of that canyon. I want you to hear the immensity and feel the immensity and see the immensity of the 3,000 feet of gorge above you. I want you to hear the running water. I want you to see a 17-year-old out on top of some rapids with a fly rod, fishing. Strike, 7-inch rainbow. I want you to see him tying the treble hook into the tail of that little rainbow and putting on a lead weight and dropping that weight into the top of the waterfall so that through a long cascading gorge, maybe 30 yards of granite, and see that weight go down, taking that rainbow. I want you to imagine what was in this boy's mind. A lunker, hog, brown trout. How'd he know that? The line came down clearly through the water, stopped. The boy smoked. He lit a cigarette and sat down on his haunches and watched as the line stuck in the water and then slowly, after about a minute, began to go this way. The line moved 1 inch, 2 inches, 3 inches, began to swim up into the water, and he knew he had hit it. Set the hook. Whom! Wham! Double rod bending. Fish running out through the lower part of the rapids, down to get out of the canyon stream. And at the edge, the boy had to go out and stop the fish before it went over the water, and then bring it back. Slowly bring it back so it turned and he could see a 24-inch brown trout out in the clear water. Slowly he brought the fish in. Slowly he steered the fish into the side pool where he could wade out into a sandy shoal. And slowly he brought, after about 10 minutes, that fish into his hand. Brought it up. 1 minute. Do I put it back? We kept it. We cooked it. But the moment was so clearly beautiful in my mind, I had to think about the granite that I was on today, out at Eastern Point. All those rocks carved and brought. How they got there, I don't know, to make that breakwater. I had to think about 2 days ago with my two, I don't know how to say it, they're not nephews, they're great-grandchildren, they're two boys, Nico and Byron, fishing at Conomo Point on bare feet and dancing over the rocks. I could have never danced the way I did at age 17 had I not grown up in Gloucester fishing on the breakwater. That's my story. And I hate to tell you, there's another fish story associated with that, but I don't have time to tell it. And it's even more interesting than that story.
Another time. Another time.
Yes, come back.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Wendy? And please say your name
when you come up. Oh,
okay.
Oh,
my whole name?
Yeah. Okay. My name is Wendy Fitting. And this is a story about how I became a minister. No, wait. It's a story about how I became a thief. And it takes place at Mal's discount department store, which replaced, I think, King's over in what's now the Stop and Shop Plaza. And I was 21. I was living in Boston, and I had gotten to this place by going to a very wonderful private girls' school, classical education, 5 years of Latin. Couldn't stand it. Had to bust out of that Girl Scout camp in 1967. Went to New York University in Greenwich Village to study to be a minister. It didn't happen. All hell broke loose. The weathermen blew up the building on 11th Street. I saw it from the library at NYU. Dropped out, moved to Boston with my boyfriend, and we broke up. So I was looking for work, and I was hitchhiking. And I got a ride with this old dude in a beat-up station wagon, and I asked him why he had so many rubber bands on the gear shift. And he said, you never know when you're going to need a rubber. I told him I was looking for work. He said, call this number. It was his wife. I called, met her in this Brookline apartment with heavy, dark furniture, heavy damask curtains, and I had no idea what this was. She was very serious. She questioned me about my observation skills, which I said were excellent. And then her sidekick, Frank Gisto, put his hand on his hip, pulled back his coat, and revealed a gun. So I thought, well, this is going to be interesting. And I learned how to try to trick employees of stores into stealing money. And the crews would go out and beat up rented cars. The wine and beer bottles would bang around on the floor in the back seat. We used very colorful language. We sped when we drove. And we really wanted to catch those bastards at the cash registers stealing the money. So when we went into a store, we had various ways of trapping the people. To this day, I remember the names on the name tags. I remember license plate numbers. I learned a lot in this business. So my friend Joanne had come to work there. She was an anthroposophist, of all things, from St. Louis to start a Waldorf school, wound up at the detective agency. I was in the line buying a bunch of stuff at Mal's, and we loved coming to Gloucester. And she came up with a $5.99 turtleneck and said, when the drawer was open, she said, here, maybe this will hide the scars on Daddy's neck, and gave the clerk the exact change. The person behind us, working with us, watched to see what happened with that money. So it was Christmas time, and I was in Mal's, and the boss, who carried her own gun in her purse, told me that they were recognizing me, so I had to wear a disguise. I wore a wig and a raccoon coat, and I was switching a ticket. You take a ticket off of a low-priced item and put it on a pair of hockey gloves, and they're supposed to know at the cash register. I was switching a ticket, and over the Muzak came Adeste Fidelis, O come all ye faithful. And I'm standing in Mal's, switching a ticket, and I thought, I can't do this anymore. Finally got out of there and went to work in the oldest institution for mentally handicapped people in the Western Hemisphere, where I got a better education than I ever got at Harvard Divinity School. That's it.
I'll start sitting. This is a story that I wanted to tell at a memorial service about 2 weeks ago. This memorial service was for a friend of mine named Paul McPherson, who was a carpenter, and he passed away a very short time ago. And I wasn't that close with Paul as a friend, but back in the 90s and the first part of the first decade of the 2000s, I was in the habit of doing shows in Gloucester, and the shows were about the town. I would pick different stories, and I would personalities, and I would do a dance, drama, music, poetry show about the town. And Paul was also a performer, and he, you know, so we crossed paths a lot. So there was this one time he called me up. He actually renovated my ex-wife's and my house, so I got to know him a little bit there. And then afterwards, as a carpenter myself, we interacted occasionally. But on this occasion, it must have been 98 or maybe 1999, I forget. He called me up and he said, Carl, I have an idea for a show. And I should preface this to say, at the memorial service, everybody spoke of Paul as a guru and a saint and a spirit, such a true spiritual man. That was not my experience of Paul. And this is an example. He called me up, Carl, I have an idea for a show. And this show was for HAWC, Help for Abused Women and Children, which is a local organization which helps people who are abused in their household, women and children abused in their household, who have nowhere else to go. It's an amazing organization, and it's grown enormously. This was a fundraiser, and the fundraiser was to take place in Americold, which is a huge warehouse on the other side of the harbor. It's usually storing fish, and it's all concrete. So it would be like performing in a garbage can, but of enormous size. So Paul said, here's my idea. I want you to perform in and choreograph a version of the Full Monty. In public, Paul? Yes, in public. All right, we should talk about this. So I went over to his house and we spoke about it. And he explained the whole idea with Linda Amaro. They concocted this idea, and they said, I'd never done a striptease. And I wasn't about to start at the age of 45 or 50, whatever I was. But it was a really important event. There were a lot of great people performing, so I decided I would take it on. So I asked him, what's the music? And he said, well, it's going to be Tom Jones singing You Can Leave Your Hat On. 2 minutes. Okay. So we got together, all of them. Hunkiest men in Gloucester, people like Gordy Bear, you know, and they dressed us in slickers and big fisherman's boots. And the big question for Paul, for me, was, what are we going to do at the end, Paul? And he explained the idea to me, and I couldn't quite see it at all. But you know, I just got engrossed in the choreography. I'm watching, how did the men in the movie take off their clothes, and the music starts, and we took off our slickers and we threw it into the audience, and the music, he's saying, you can take your hat off, no, you can take your shoes off, you can take your hat off, we took our ties off, we took a belt, and at one point we took our belts out and we did something that I saw on the movie. And then at the very end, because we had Velcro pants, we reached down, ripped off our pants, and there, in our boxer shorts, was a big red lobster pasted to our boxer shorts. And that was our version of the Full Monty. Paul, you taught me that you can make a great show out of anything.
Well, I'm Greg Boher, and I've got a cheat sheet just in case I need it. I hope I won't. A few of you know me, and you know that I work at C.B. Fisk. We're over in West Gloucester. We build pipe organs for churches and concert halls and universities all over the world. And there are 28 of us over there in a big shop, and I've been there 35 years doing this. And over that time, we've had quite a number of apprentices. And back a few years, we had an apprentice who was rather special. To many of us, he came to the company as young as you can start and work in a shop like that. Because of the insurance, you have to be 18. And he was just a few days over 18 when he started at the shop. And almost 3 years later, when he was 10 days short of his 21st birthday, he died. He was at home on a weekend. He took a nap, and he never woke up. He had a heart condition that we didn't know about. it had been, he'd known about it for a while, but it had been dormant and it just hadn't been a factor in his life. But he went to sleep one day and didn't wake up. And we were pretty crushed. This young man had, he fit into the shop. It's a crazy bunch of people over there. People come really from all over the world to work at this place that we have and learn how to be pipe organ builders. And so we've got people from different countries, we've got people from all over the United States, old, young, in between, all kinds of backgrounds, second careers, third careers for some, first careers for people like him. But he fit in really well. He was extremely precise. He was a hard worker. He was really bright. He was just one of those kids that you see sometimes, if you're lucky in your career, that you can imagine taking your place when you're old. And there were more than just me who thought he was going to be one of the leaders of the company in years to come. So we tried to teach him everything, and he just took it on and took it on and took it on, and he learned to make wooden pipes, he learned to make wind chests, he learned to make wind ducts, he learned to make key action, he learned to make casework, and he especially liked to go out on installation. When we finish a job here in Gloucester, we build the whole thing, make it play, and then take it wherever it's going to go and put it all back together. And that was a part that he really liked. And among the things that we put him through was a lot of teasing. He got a nickname just like everybody gets a nickname, and his nickname was Salad Boy, because as an expression of his religious beliefs, he was a Seventh-day Adventist, he was a vegetarian. Well, we picked on him for that. And when we were on installation with him, all of us carnivores would go to a steakhouse someplace, and he would completely good-naturedly come along and have toasted cheese sandwich and a salad. So it was Salad Boy from then on. And so he quickly became really central to the operation of the place. And when he died, his parents, he was the oldest child in his family, and his parents, of course, were totally crushed. And we had no idea what to do for them and that family, who were so bereft and experiencing so much grief. And yet they knew what to do for us. They asked us if we would build his coffin. And we had a mahogany plank that we had squirreled away years before that was 20 feet long, a foot and a half wide, and an inch and a half thick. And from that mahogany plank, we built a coffin for this young man, which of course was the centerpiece at his funeral. And almost every hand in the shop did something on that coffin that the family had honored us with the request to build. So right up until the end, this young man gave us everything he had. He gave us his youth, he gave us his intellect. He got some of his world-weary colleagues to see things his way and be excited about the job that they had held for maybe a little bit too long. And I'll never forget him.
This is a little different, and I haven't really done the timing on it, but I'm going to try to be succinct and read a little bit of it because it's long. But the reason I got permission to read it is because the person who wrote it is in prison. Gloucester boy, I don't even know what he did, but he's been in prison for a while, and he sends things to the Writers' Center. And he's a good writer. And it was so apropos of local, I couldn't resist. Well, he opens up and he talks about when the Moonies came to Gloucester. Do you all remember that?
Yeah.
1980s. And as he says, a working class Catholic group of boys in town, the first thing the Moonies do is buy Cardinal Cushing's villa. And what more could, you know, come on, that's an act of war. And then he goes on to say, if you want to throw fuel on that fire, you should then purchase an East Gloucester landmark Bob's Clam Shack and turn it into your new tuna fishing headquarters. That's what they did next. The citizens of Gloucester were madder than hornets leaving a batted nest. Now, as he says, he and his friends were knockabout Gloucester kids who were growing up too fast. And the hysteria didn't affect them too much. We had our own ways to pass the time. But we were Gloucester men, through and through. And if these Moonies presented a threat to the home front, then we were going to deal with the issue in our own way. Oh, the exuberance of youth. So they concoct a mission where they go up the granite hill across the street from Bob's Clam Shack late at night, get slingshots, and start firing away at the clam shack, falling back in formation, going forward, a volley, and this goes on for some time. Then, through some of our nefarious activities, we'd ended up with a case of 9-volt transistor radio batteries. We tried to sell them, but didn't have any luck. Stone thought they might make good slingshot ammo, so we took a few up to the back field where our crew hung out and launched it. They were excellent ammo. Even made a cool buzzing sound as they flew through the air. We knew our next covert assault upon the Moonies would be done using these formidable projectiles. Our friend Clark, he never had much luck. He sawed off a finger making a shelf, fell in the bushes taking a leak while drunk, and nearly froze to death until his neighbors... Well, anyway, Clarkie and the rest of the boys go up on the hill to really attack the Moonies. We waited with our position set at the top of the hill. Barry made the first call, ready, aim, fire. The first volley was on the money and made so much more noise than the lead balls. Now, this was an assault, so they do this throughout the night. But all of a sudden, a flashlight beam appeared about 30 feet down the hill. We did not know who it was, but we knew what to do. Barry called out, "Let them have it!" We fired a volley of 9 volts toward the light beams. Fire one more volley and fall back. They do it, but they couldn't go back because the cavalry is coming, and so they run. But Clarkie's not there. So we waited for Clarkie until about 2, didn't show up. We go to his house the next morning. He's lying on the couch in his screen porch, cuts all over his body, a dark red mark on his cheek, and a bit of a shiner under one eye. He had been taken hostage by a Moonie recon squad. It was a Moonie strike force that had climbed the hill with the flashlights. His bum leg had caused him to take a spill upon retreat, and the Moonies captured his dumbass. They dragged him through the briars, bumping him off of huge granite boulders, and brought him to the interrogation chamber within the confines of Bob's Clam Shack. They slapped him around a bit and demanded names of his cohorts. He had the spine of a jellyfish. We knew he gave us up, but we were fearless in those days and couldn't stop laughing. The Moonies had had enough of our nighttime sorties. They had flown in the current world taekwondo champion, who was Korean, just like the Reverend Sung Young Moon, and hired him to head their security force. It gives me no end of great pleasure to know that the current world taekwondo champ had to fend off 9-volt batteries being launched at him at about 150 miles per hour. We had to change our tactics because you know that good Gloucester men don't give up. But eventually, everyone in town learned that these poor souls were harmless. They assimilated to Gloucester life, and nowadays fishermen do business with them without any thought of those early days. Clarkie was no worse for wear. We got endless hours of recreation breaking his balls about the debacle. He later met a tragic end, and as I told you, he had no luck. But the story of his antics keeps a bright memory alive for all who knew him. The city of Gloucester has many problems, but it breeds strong men. Some men, like myself, were misguided, but you cannot take away our pride for the city we grew up in. We felt there was a real threat, and we handled it our own way. That is the real Gloucester spirit, which I see dying in the fishing industry losses of today. If I was a young man in Gloucester today, my slingshot would be aimed at the headquarters of NOAA. Who would they hire to stop us? And the great thing for us at the Gloucester Writers' Center is that the Moonies have been our great friends, and unfortunately the place across the street is sold, but they've let us park there. So we have hope that the new owners will be as good as they were. Thank you.
Wow.
We have a special guest storyteller with us tonight, known in some parts as the storyteller of Gloucester. It gives me great honor and fun to introduce Lenny Laquada from the Gloucester House.
Hello, folks.
Hi. Hi.
This is different.
So what have we discussed this evening? We've discussed local stories. I saw you in your... That was interesting. And that was pretty Gloucester story.
Yeah.
I tell stories, too. But I tell stories that are historically Gloucester. And I sort of think that if you're going to learn about a community, you might as well learn about its people. So those are the things that I like to tell. And I do so because I really care about the history of the community. And if you want the community to survive and continue, you have to project what the history of this thing was, and so that people know where they are and where they've been, maybe they'll have a little direction where they're going. So I tell stories about all sorts of people. And has anyone done this here before? So I'll give you some choices today. How's that? We'll start off with a very young man by the name of Roger Babson. See, Roger Babson was an incorrigible young man. So incorrigible, he got expelled from school in the first grade. But they let him back into school. By the time Roger got to the sixth grade, he was so much trouble, he had received 47 beatings in 1 year. You'd think he would have learned after like 20. Well, he finally got to the eighth grade. No one thought Roger was very bright, so they decided to keep him back a grade. And then off to high school he goes. For 4 years, Roger just either doesn't show up or does nothing during science class. And come graduation day, when all his friends are receiving their diplomas, young Roger doesn't have enough credits. But there is no way this young disruptive force that has terrorized the school system for 13 years is going to spend 1 day longer in the system. They decide they're going to give him a blank piece of paper and send him out the door. Get rid of him. And off he goes. Before Roger's 32 years old, he's a multimillionaire. The only thing Roger likes doing more than make money is spending money. One of the first things he does when he comes across a whole bunch of money is he goes out and buys the entire center part of what we call Cape Ann. 3,000 acres. Now, when you live on the mainland and you buy 3,000 acres, that's really not a big deal. But when you live on an island and it's the middle of the Depression time and you're out buying 3,000 acres, oh, that's a big deal. Well, he takes all the unemployed stone workers that are working in the quarries on the north side of the island and he has them come over and cut walking paths all through this acreage. And then to keep the men busy, he tells them to put inscriptions on these big boulders sitting along the edges of the walking paths. Simple things. Trust, courage, idea, ideals, help mother, get a job, integrity. When he's all done, he takes the land, he turns it into a sanctuary and a reservoir, and he gives it back to the community. Every year thereafter, he sets up a college fund, sends two kids from our community all the way through college, pays the bill. And then he realized the little hospital on the other side of town needs a maternity ward. So he goes out, and he builds him one. And knowing how expensive it is to keep that little hospital of ours operating, he endows that hospital $30 million. You see, before the incorrigible young kid is all done, that same young man that got expelled and beaten up and kept back, the young man they sent out the door with a blank piece of paper, Roger Babson goes out and establishes three colleges. Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts is his most famous college. But he sets up a college in Eureka, Kansas, and he sets up an all-women's college in Florida. Roger finally did go back to high school, graduated, and at his father's insistence, he went on to college. Wasn't very good at science, but he was one heck of a mathematician. Roger went to MIT. It was from MIT that Roger took a job working for Wall Street. One day while he was working, he had asked his boss, "How come my friends can buy these stocks on the street for 25 cents less than we sell them?" Roger was told to shut up and mind his own business. And then they proceeded to fire him. Well, Roger remembered that. He became very good at his trade. Roger Babson became a world-class statistician. You see, he was so good and accurate with his numbers and formulas that he became one of the main clearinghouses of all of Wall Street. Those brokerage firms paid him tens of millions of dollars for his information on where they should invest their money. It was because of Roger Babson and the way he put statistical information all together that we now have Standard & Poor's and Moody's. See, Roger predicted the stock market crash in 1929. He ran for president of the United States under the Prohibition Party. But it was the $30 million that he gave our little hospital that was the real kicker. You see, it was 1910, and Roger became very interested in a little mining company in South Africa, a little company by the name of De Beers. He invested a bunch of money, and he gave this little local hospital, Addison Gilbert, $30 million with the diamond certificates. And that's the story of an incorrigible young kid Gloucester, Massachusetts, named Roger Babson.
Well, thank you everybody for coming tonight. We don't have the next Fishtail scheduled, but we're every other month, maybe every 6 weeks coming up. Yet our next topic, our next theme is going to be chickens. chicken stories suggested by Annie and I've mentioned it out there in among some friends, and they're like, "I would love to tell a story about chickens. I have chickens." And so anyway, we're gonna do that next, and it'll be posted on the Gloucester Writers Center website. And it'll be in a blast coming up. Hopefully we'll be toward the end of September. Thank you everybody for coming tonight. It's wonderful to see new faces and new folks. Thanks for your stories and for your heartfelt sharing. And I just really appreciate it. And I collect them and take them home. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.